Well, I'd like to welcome to the program Lee Tesdall. He's an Iowa farmer with connections to Gaza and the West Bank. Lee, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here, Ed.
So tell us about your farming experience here in Iowa. You come from a long stock of farmers.
Yeah, both my grandfathers and grandmothers started out as farmers. One near Acworth, Iowa. That's on my mother's side in a Quaker community there. Mm-hmm. And he didn't farm for very long. He went to find greener pastures, I guess.
And what possible greener pastures are there than farmland?
That's a good question. He became a teacher, so he probably made even less money. And then on my father's side, that's where I live now, in northern Polk County. And they came from a line of, they were Norwegian immigrants to northern Polk County. Yeah.
So, and you raise sheep and kernza. We've talked about kernza on this program. It's a perennial weed.
Right.
What else do you raise besides those two crops? Is there something else?
Well, on my 80-acre farm, as you said, I have kernza, 7 acres of kernza, 5 acres of hay for my sheep.
Sure.
We bale that every summer. And then I rent out 50 acres for row crop corn soy production to a neighbor. So I get cash rent for that. And then I have 3 acres of prairie strips. And I have about 8 acres of perennial buffer strips along the creek and a waterway.
And the sheep.
And the sheep.
And they're guarded by a llama.
They're guarded by Lenny the Llama.
Lenny with two L's.
with
should be Yenny the Llama.
Yenny the Llama, yeah, that's right, yeah.
So what's your connection to Palestine?
Well, going back, I guess going way back, I think we came out of Africa through Palestine, probably. But because Gaza and Palestine lie right along the Levant Trail, whereby African modern humans coming out of Africa moved northwards. So, but that's a long time ago.
Yeah, I don't want to go back that far. What's your own historical?
So, condition? In 1914, my maternal grandfather, who was a professor at William Penn College, had gone to Germany to study, but then also had taken a Holy Land trip. So, just before the First World War started, he was trekking around and actually walked through parts of Palestine, took a train on north into Syria. So I have his diary, and I read about his trip. That's the first direct family connection. And then later, 1949, my parents embarked from New York City to Alexandria, Egypt, on the Muhammad Ali Kabir ship. That was his title, to work as Quaker humanitarian workers in Gaza.
Okay.
And so, and then later I went back to teach English in Amman, Jordan, visited Gaza at the invitation
You went to teach, yeah.
Right, in Jordan, right.
And you married a Palestinian woman,
right? Yeah. My wife was from Lida. Yeah.
And I believe she passed away.
Right, correct, yeah.
But your kids are, you know, part whatever you are from European descent.
Right.
And the other half of Palestinian descent.
Correct.
So you got a pretty strong connection there.
Pretty strong.
Yeah.
Very strong.
Yeah, very strong. And your two sons both live over in that part of the world.
Right.
Yeah. So what do you know about farming in both Gaza and the West Bank?
Right. So my wife was not from a peasant or a farming background. They were from a town background. Her grandfather and her father started out as selling shoes and repairing shoes and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously, living there, I learned quite a lot about agriculture as I went along. I remember the photograph of the almond orchard when I went to visit my student in Gaza in 1977. In the background, there's an almond orchard blooming in December.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I noticed the crops that were being exported. And I would go shopping in Amman, Jordan, and I would see some of the produce that came from Gaza or the West Bank in the markets in Jordan.
And these are crops, almond trees, raised by Palestinian families.
Right, at that time, yeah.
And that was back in the 90s, 80s?
That was 77.
70s, wow.
It was winter break. Okay. I remember he invited me to visit winter break. At that time, you could still take a taxi across the Allenby Bridge up to Jerusalem, and you'd get a taxi into Gaza. Of course, that's all gone now.
I was in Israel about the same time, 1978 or 9.
There we go.
That's another story, though. We'll save that for another day.
Let's do another program.
I mean, I think everybody is aware of how much devastation has occurred in Gaza, no matter what side of the conversation you're on.
Right.
And I think everything I've been seeing is that the agricultural devastation is as bad as any of the destruction that's happening. I mean,
right.
It wasn't just the Israeli Defense Forces going after the cities or military strongholds of Hamas. They were going after, they were destroying the food production as well.
Right. I think that's true. I think I have a number here. 86% of Gaza's cultivated agricultural land has been severely damaged. And as of July 2025, only 1.5% of land in the strip remained accessible in Arab.
1.5%,
yeah.
Okay.
So prior to October 7, they were producing quite a lot of local food.
Right.
Gaza's pretty small, the Gaza Strip. It's actually a quarter the size of Polk County with more than four times the population. So
right.
It's
25% the size of one Iowa county with four times as many people.
This
is the most populous county in the state, too. So that's
it is. Yeah.
That's a lot of people. I mean, what, 2 million people live in the Gaza Strip or lived in the Gaza Strip?
Yeah, two or a little more. Yeah. So when my parents were there in 49-50, the AFSC, the Quakers, did a kind of informal survey. They think there were about 200,000 refugees. Now Gaza was a place since time immemorial, so there were people, there were Gazans living there, but then 200,000 new people moved in after 48 because they were expelled from farther north.
Oh, 200,000 additional Palestinians.
Right. So those were the refugees.
They were expelled from what became the State of Israel.
Correct. Right. And so those were the people that my parents were, the Quakers were helping.
Okay.
Yeah. Right.
So the state of agriculture, I mean, when 90-something percent of your farmland is destroyed, their livelihoods are destroyed as well. There were people who made a living as farmers. What has happened to them?
Right. They're living in tents along the coast or wherever.
They're not farming.
They're not farming. It would be my guess that being very resourceful, that there are little plots here and there of mint and arugula that you and I both grow, and a few cukes and a couple of tomatoes here and there, and maybe some rabbits and maybe some chickens here and there, but. Most of it's gone.
So they're growing food for their own consumption to the extent that
people
they can.
People are trying. Yeah.
So what about the wonderful peace plan that Trump has come up with that basically divides the Gaza Strip, gives a big chunk of it to Israel, and leaves a fraction of the original strip in its place? What about that? How, I mean, beyond agriculture, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, my thoughts are that the people there are resilient, and that whatever plans get cooked up overseas without the input of indigenous people, by the way, will probably fall by the wayside at some point. I can't imagine that those grandiose plans actually happening. Mm-hmm. I certainly hope they won't. Most Arab countries will refuse to take Palestinian refugees from Gaza. They've been refugees for 76 years, right, in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And most of them came from somewhere else, and they'll just refuse to move, I think. So I think whatever Mr. Kushner and the others come up with, I think it's going to flame out and go away. Gaza is an ancient place. I mean, some of our basic food materials, came out of the Fertile Crescent, right? Mm. Wheat, barley, lentils, these crops, and it's an ancient place with resilient people. Mm. And I just don't see the skyscrapers and the resorts happening that some folks...
Trump Gaza. Right, yeah, right, right. So in terms of, agriculture, the other portion of the Palestinian homeland that still exists, at least on paper, is the West Bank. We know that Israeli settlers continue to incur into the West Bank and set up their own towns and own their own houses and taking Palestinian land to do that. But how is that affecting agriculture specifically in the West Bank?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. So, and by the way, there are also Palestinian. There are about 2 million Palestinians who are
in Israel.
Who are citizens of Israel.
Right,
Who, by the way, don't have all the rights that a Jewish Israeli would have. But that's another discussion. But one thing we see is settlers coming in and destroying olive trees.
In addition to just building houses, they're destroying
in areas where all of us enjoy the Palestinian olive oil, right? That comes out of the Jenin area. But so that's one direct thing. Another thing they've been doing is bringing in their own herds of sheep and goats to go through fields and crops, Palestinian fields and crops, to damage them and destroy them. So that's another thing that's been happening.
And a reasonable person would ask, well, how are they getting away with that?
Right.
What should be in place to stop them? I mean, the international law, the international community has said that these settlements are illegal.
Right.
And Israel, the state of Israel, has, maybe occasionally paid lip service to that recognition, but for the most part has done nothing to stop it.
Right.
Is that fair?
It looks that way. I mean, one of the things that we say is that the U.S. Congress, is occupied by the state of Israel, essentially. So United States of America is really the only power that could make a big difference, I think, in Israeli policy. That our U.S. Congress is basically, for a number of reasons, very much in tune with the Zionist objectives in Palestine. And it's been that way for a long time, since Harry Truman. Since Harry Truman. Mm-hmm. And, it wasn't as severe in those days. Mm-hmm. There was probably more European support for Zionism in the 50s and working in the 60s.
And again, Zionism being not just the existence of Israeli people in that region, but the confiscation of other people's land in order to expand the state.
We usually define it as political Judaism. I mean, that's a simple definition.
Right.
But the idea was, and of course there are various flavors of Zionism over the years, but basically that Palestine should be a homeland for Jews in which the Jewish population would have precedent over the indigenous population in rights and so on.
Because we all can't get along?
Well,
we should be able to.
We should be able to, but there's that kind of messianic idea that that some Christian Zionists and Jewish Zionists hold that Palestine was promised to the Jewish people, and where some of the folks are coming from.
So the impact on the lives of farmers, I mean, there are people who are losing their livelihood, but also losing their land. And are there international groups that are getting involved in some way that express solidarity with the farm community? I mean, farmers of any nationality in any situation where there's war and turmoil and oppression and imperialism, they ought to be defended.
Right.
And is there anyone rising to their defense?
Yes, there are people. There are Israelis. I just watched a video this morning of a group of rabbis who were coming out to Palestinian land to plant new olive trees on Palestinian land. So there are there are Israelis who get it, and there are international groups also who are coming in to the West Bank to stand with Palestinian villagers and peasants to witness the Israeli settlers' attacks and, you know, film video and try to defend the Palestinians.
Yeah. And so. Well, that's encouraging. I mean, maybe the most obvious solution is eventually a political one where the Israeli government is, the current government is replaced by one that is more moderate, more progressive, more willing to work with the international community and Israel's neighbors to recognize the importance of some settlement that's just for everybody.
Right. Yeah, I was just listening to a lecture by Dr. Ilan Pappe, who actually teaches at University of Exeter in England. He's Israeli. And his idea is there has to be a one-state solution.
Yeah. And I think everybody who's objective about this has moved beyond the notion of a possible two-state solution.
Right, right. Bit of a joke.
Well, Lee, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
We've been talking to Lee Testel, Iowa farmer with some deep connections in Palestine.